This is File 33, Cycle 2. This is Jean McMillan. Today's date is April 18th, 2018. I am interviewing George Massey. He's going to talk about his family background, land trust, Habitat for Humanities, and the Women's Support Services. But first, we'll start with the genealogical information. What is your name?
I'm George Massey.
Where were you born?
Hartford, Connecticut.
When were you born?
1946.
June 26th?
June 26th, 1946.
And your parents' names?
Eugene Massey and Marie Massey.
And Marie's maiden name was?
Noonan.
Spell it, please.
N-O-O-N-A-N.
Okay.
Both from the Midwest, both from the Chicago area.
Ah, okay. Do you have siblings?
I have a sister, a year and a half older, Joanne, and a brother, 4 years older, Eugene.
And how did you come to this area?
I got a job with the Dairy Herd Improvement Association. That's a farmer's cooperative that keeps records on dairy cows, for production records for the benefit of the farmer. So that brought me to Salisbury, and I went around to probably 20 different farms for the evening milking and then for the morning milking, wrote down the information, sent it off to Cornell, and the farmers got printouts on all of their cows, so they knew which ones were making them money. The farmers, when I first moved here, I didn't have a place to stay, and I used to camp in the farm fields, and the farmers, most of them invited me in for breakfast.
Oh, good.
So it was very, very nice, because it was a nice way to come into the area, because I knew kind of something that was going on here. Mm-hmm. In the early 70s, this was 1971, dairy farming was still a going concern, and so it was interesting to see all these small farms. It turns out it was kind of their swan song, but they were wonderful people, and it was a wonderful way to come to the area.
Was this the same type of work that George Tuttle did?
It's exactly the same work.
Ah, good. Now, how did you get involved with the land trust?
Well, in 1970, when winter was coming on in 1971, I found a farmhouse to rent in Cornwall, and I found a couple of people to share it with me. And from 1971 to 79, I lived in Cornwall, and I was kind of a 60s dropout. Wood stove, vegetable garden, uh-huh. Simple life. Then one of the owners of the farmhouse returned from the West and wanted to live in the farmhouse, so I had to find new housing. Mm-hmm. So my farm connections held me in good stead. This was just the time when Norm Sills was retiring from farming and Jeffrey Sills was going to take it up.
Yep.
Jeffrey had just built a house on Twin Lakes, in fact, the house where Norm Sills later lived and then uh-huh. the Hex now live.
Yep, yep.
And he was going to live there, and so he asked, he knew I needed a place, and he's one of the people that had lived with me in Cornwall. So he said, if you'll come and take care of the cows on Sunday, you can live in that farmhouse. So I lived there for about a year, and that was what got me to Salisbury. And in the course of that year, we were doing a fair amount of contra dancing up in Sheffield, and one of the people that used to come to that was living on the Hewitts property on Selig Hill, and they said, there's a house going to be coming available there next year. Are you interested? Because by this time, Hamlet Hill Farm had been sold
yes.
to Peter Finley, so the clock was ticking for me to get out of that farmhouse. So I went over and talked to the Hewitts, and they were very gracious and very helpful, and so I moved into that house in probably 80, it could have been 81, and have been there for the next 35 years very happily.
Good. Okay, and the land trust came out of?
Well, the land trust came out of that kind of switch in town, and I think the whole feel of Salisbury really does have a reputation of a town that is very involved in nonprofit organizations. Mm-hmm. Rounding out the community and making the community really work. I think there was an issue about water quality in the aquifers and stuff, and I was in conversation with Bill Morrill about some of these things, And a number of people on the land trust were leaving it. I think Bill among them, and maybe Curtis Rand. People that had positions in the town. Bill was on planning and zoning. Curtis was in the wetlands. And they felt that there was too much opportunity for conflict of interest mm-hmm. for land trust properties and mm-hmm. things that the town would be involved with. So at this time, Mary Alice was taking over as the chairman. And there were...
This was Mary Alice White.
Yeah, Mary Alice White was taking over as chairman. And there were probably six or seven vacancies on the land trust. And I believe Bill Morrow asked me if I'd be interested, and I said sure.
Oh, good. Why? Why was this interesting to you?
Well, part of what's interesting to me, one of my quotes that I quote myself on is, I got here by accident, but I stayed on purpose.
Wonderful.
And the reason that I stayed is not that I had a good job or not that I had a lot of friends. It was that the landscape was so engaging. The villages, the farm, the forested hillsides, the lakes, the rivers, the streams. This was and still is an incredibly wonderful place to live. It's a beautiful ecosystem and one that the humans work in fairly well, I think.
Yes, you're absolutely right. I'm so glad that you said that. Now, when you got on the land trust as a board member, what were some of your responsibilities?
Well, what we all do on the land trust is have to monitor one or more easements. Most of the land that the Salisbury protects is done through a conservation easement. And in a conservation easement, the owner gives up his rights to do certain things. Usually it's to build houses or subdivide and to keep the house, keep the land in a conservation state. Now, that can allow for forestry, it can allow for farming, it can allow for passive recreation. So this is mostly we have these arrangements. You know, we've had the Belchers, the Hewitts, the Box, the Thomases, McLarens. You know, many people have made very generous donations of conservation easements on their property, but part of the responsibility of the land trust is to visit those and make sure that the rules are being followed. So that's something we all do. The other thing we do is we look into trying to get new land. We talk to landowners who have land that we think is important. One of the properties we'll talk specifically on later what will be what we call Torrey Hill, which was the Blum property at Fairfield Farm. And so that was obviously to us a very important property. And so we met with the Blums and we said, when you're ready to do something with that, let us know. Obviously, we like it when people give us things, but for important properties, we just want to have the opportunity. We want people to know that we are going to do what we can to conserve them. So all of the land trust members are kind of involved in that.
Who makes the rules about the easements and so forth?
Good question. They're very specific, particularly when someone donates an easement on their land. We'll be very amenable to the kinds of things they want to do on them. Basically, they can't seriously interfere with the real conservation interest. But if they want to continue forestry, if they want to have hunting, if they want to do certain kinds of agriculture, if they want to have a farm with more of a kind of more buildings on it, we can have an easement that allows for agricultural buildings. Or some of them we do with actually a cutout. So it's 60 acres, but we cut out 4 acres and don't put that in the easement so the farmer can do whatever he wants in there. And he doesn't have to come and say, can I do this, can I do that. He'll have his own little inholding. And then we'll be protecting the farmland around that.
Is there a minimum number of acres?
There isn't. We have taken one very small easement almost as a favor. It was adjacent to a much larger one. It was just a few acres. We certainly wouldn't have taken it on its own, but as far as going to monitor it, you're monitoring the 40 acres. You can monitor the 42 acres. So.
Okay. I can understand the cutout because my husband and I lived next door to Jack Blum's farm.
Okay.
And we had a 2-acre plot that was cut out of his bigger portion.
Yep.
Okay. I think I want to talk about the properties now, and then we'll go back to accreditation.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Oh, let's do accreditation. I can do that very, very quickly.
Okay, let's do accreditation.
Back in the, back around 2000, I think it was, the Nature Conservancy got into some trouble. They had, one of the tools of conservation can be to get a big chunk of land and then sell off a few pieces of it to help pay for it. And that's entirely respectable operation. Okay. The reason the Nature Conservancy got into trouble was that they let their board of directors have first shot at these cutouts. They weren't sold below market, but they weren't arm's length transactions.
That's not right.
It isn't right, and they admitted it wasn't right, but then there was a brouhaha in Washington about all these people taking tax advantage, because again, if you give an easement and it has public benefit, you're allowed to take a tax benefit on the difference between what that land was worth now and what it was worth before, but you have to show that there's a clear benefit. You can't just protect your backyard and then claim a benefit. So the Land Trust Alliance then kind of got up and said, we're going to make sure these things don't happen. So they organized a fairly complex group of rules, of procedures and policies about how land protection should be done. And so if you go through, most people were doing this for the most part anyway, but to go through the accreditation process, you sign on and your shoulder is looked over continuously that you agree to these things, and then they want you to show that you're doing them, or if you haven't been doing them, you promise to do them, and they're going to come back and check. So it makes the whole process a little bit more complicated, but it makes it much more secure that it's getting done right and will withstand the test of time, because these easements are forever, and down the road you get these, you know, people challenge them, well, why can't I do this?
Yeah.
And so we have to have this good information, everything in place, the appraisal's all done right if it's going to involve a tax benefit. So the accreditation process was
arduous. Very arduous.
It was arduous, and in my view, it was a bit more complicated than it needs to be. But nonetheless, it's very important, and it's very important for the whole land trust community that everyone is protected, but the community understands that the land trust is self-regulating itself strenuously and in an important way to make sure that it's not abused, because these tax benefits are a major major help to get these easements, and to lose that would be very hard. And so they got this done, and in fact since then we've had the benefit of now if you make a charitable contribution of an easement, you can carry that forward 15 years.
Ooh.
And the thinking there is, a lot of people are land rich, right? You have a farm.
Yeah.
What good's an $800,000 deduction to you if your income's only $65,000?
Right.
So it allows people of modest means to still get some benefit for bigger gifts.
Oh, good. And you're checked on, aren't you, now that you've got
We'll get checked on. You know, the IRS hasn't knocked on our door exactly, but they knocked on our door once in terms of what someone else was doing. And that all came out okay.
Good.
But any of these things at any time can come back.
But you feel more secure because you know you're doing the right thing and it's rules and regulated.
As we went back and did this, we found there were some holes in our record keeping.
Yeah.
And also, the standards of what the record keeping are much more than they were at that time.
Sure.
So even all the records we had got brought up to date to today's standards. So it was an expensive and a bit cumbersome, but it's in place now. And of course, one of the offshoots for better and for worse, I guess probably for better, is, you know, we no longer can really be a volunteer organization.
Yeah.
There's too much to do. So now we both have Harry White as a part-time conservation director and Shelley Harms as our executive director, who's been great. She's the one that shepherded us through the accreditation process So she was very well positioned to know where everything is and to keep this going moving forward. So we're very lucky to have her, and she's doing a great job.
And they're both paid?
They're both paid.
Okay. And
it's a wonderful system because they're both like quarter to third time employees. So they're getting paid a decent wage, but we're not hiring them for 40 hours. So we've shared. Shelley also works with the Cornwall Land Trust, and Harry works with both the Cornwall Land Trust and the Sharon Land Trust. So by sharing these people, they can get the wage they deserve, and
we can get
them at a price we can afford.
What is Harry's title?
He's Conservation Director.
Okay.
So he's the guy that goes out and does the mapping for us. We're looking at a property now. He'll produce all these photo maps from the sky and the underlayment of the soils and all these things as we assemble what the conservation values are in the property and, you know, our reasons for perhaps going forward on it.
Does that take some of the burden off the volunteers then?
Yes. I mean, we've almost always had some help with that part-time, mm-hmm. but he's really right there for us.
And oh, good.
Need, you know, recently we've moved to try and buy 200 acres from Alice Yoakum. And that came about very, very quickly. Alice was anxious to do it. There was a window there. Tim Abbott of Housatonic Valley Association had been talking with her. It looked like a deal was possible, but if we were going to do it, we were going to have an application into the state for a grant, which could provide $300,000 or $400,000, and that was due, you know, 6 weeks into the future. And it's a very—I've done two of these. It's a very complicated,
yeah.
you know, it's like a master's thesis.
Probably.
And you know, so to have Shelley and Harry there as employees,
mm-hmm.
You know, we were very hopeful that we're going to be successful. And that was put together in quick order and got in on time.
Oh,
which would have been a great strain or impossible without them.
Oh, yeah.
So
okay.
So that Harry, you know, these people were right there. Harry was out, got stuff on the land, did a preliminary hazardous waste
mm-hmm.
thing on the
mm-hmm.
land, all the things that we needed to do to have our application be complete.
Oh, wonderful.
So
okay.
We'll find out at the end of this year whether they're going to deliver a pile of money or not.
I hope so.
I do too.
Okay, tell me about Dark Hollow. Where is it located?
Dark Hollow is the dirt road that runs from kind of the Salisbury side of Salmon Kill Road over to Farnham Road. It's a diagonal road. And it belonged to the Cannon family. Before that, it was part of Yale Farm, I think, which owned
mm-hmm.
a lot of land all through there. So the Cannons wanted to sell it, and I think the Arnolds really were the original impetus that we should get together and make this happen. And so we had a number of meetings. I did the grant application for that. Bill Morrow was important on that. Lou Heck was important on that. Not sure whether Jim Dresser was in on that one or not, but we formed a kind of a fundraising and negotiating committee
mm-hmm.
to deal with the Cannons and to get ready to make money. There's an interesting story there. I did the grant application and it was refused, and I came out 20th in the list of 40 or something, and 17 got money, and we did not get money. But through the Freedom of Information Act, I could see my scoring.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So I looked at my scoring, and I said, well, this isn't right. There were a number of categories, and for each one, there were usually four things, and you could get 5 points if you had any of them.
Mm-hmm.
And the most obvious one was, it's good for fish.
Yeah.
So if you had, I never get this right, the fish that come up, like the shad and the salmon,
right.
Anomalous, something like, it's a word, something like, that those, if you had them, you got 5 points.
Mm-hmm.
If you had unusual fish, you got 5 points.
Uh-huh.
If you had healthy fish, you got 5 points. And if you could provide public access, you got 5 points, okay?
Yeah.
We had no points. And we have more than a half mile of frontage on the brook there.
Yeah.
And I had a letter from the head of the Department of Fisheries saying mm-hmm. he caught healthy fish there.
Yeah.
So these were clear misscorings.
Sure.
And also there's a scoring, how is this property in danger of development? And I already had in there an ad in the newspaper and evidence that an adjacent part that was part of the same holding had already been sold. Mm-hmm. And so we should have had 10 points there, and we had no points. So at that time, we had Roberta Willis and Andrew Rohrbach in Hartford. So I went to Hartford, and I met with both of them, and they said, well, we'll look into it. You know? So they did.
Yeah.
And about, in the meantime, to try and close that gap, there was a Belcher Trust Fund. And I get to think the Belchers, among others, had done a lot of horseback riding in and around there. And so Sarah and Ward directed that money to help close the gap. And then, 6 months later, I got a call from Andrew that they didn't admit they'd made a mistake, but they did say we were going to get the money. So the $450,000 eventually came, and that actually provided us now with a surplus. And we used some of that money to buy more land along Dark Hollow. It belonged to the Pope family. So we bought another 9-acre and a 4-acre parcel at the Salmon Kill end of Dark Hollow. Then we put the rest in our stewardship fund. We have a happy, comfortable stewardship fund, although we always need more.
Oh, yeah.
This is to protect our property and to manage our property and to be able to defend it in court if we need to. So we've had a number of kind of big chunks that have gone into that.
When did Dark Hollow actually become acquired?
I'm going to say 2003.
Okay.
That's a good guess. Mary Alice died in 2000, and I think 2003 is when that happened.
Okay. And how about Torrey Hill?
Torrey Hill, another one that I did a grant proposal for. I'm through with that now.
And I think you're happy about that.
But, well, it's very satisfying when the money comes.
Sure, but it's hard work getting it.
It's not often that I get a chance to earn $450,000. So that, as I said, we had talked to the Blums, and the Blums came to Larry Power, who was then head of Sharon Land Trust, and me, and said, you know, we're going to sell this. And so we did some negotiation, and they came down a bit in their price, so they were selling it below market. And then here's actually, this is an interesting story. The actual corner lot on the northeast corner of Long Pond Road, no, it would be the southeast corner, belonged to the Kiters.
Right.
And so they own about 300 feet along Route 41 heading south. Mm-hmm. And when we looked, and then Torrey Hill starts 50 acres, it starts after that. And we knew that we had to know what happens on that corner, because if we were going to buy Torrey Hill and someone was going to put a 25,000 square foot house up in that corner, it wouldn't be a success. The major virtue of that property is, of course, the view over to Twin Oaks and the view down to Mudge Pond.
Because we lived on that stretch, and people would line up in their cars to see the sunset.
Yeah.
And my husband always threatened to go out with a tin cup and charge a fee.
Get a little money. And you often see people there set up to paint it.
Yes.
So it really is an iconic view for everyone that travels Route 41. Mm-hmm. And so in order to set up the project at it to be its most successful, Lou Hecht and I visited the Kiters and asked them about that field, that top of the field, and they said, well, I don't think we want to have anything built there. And I said, well, that's our feeling exactly, but we really need to have it protected to allow us to then justify trying to raise $1 million to buy the next piece. And so we walked out their door and started walking up the road towards Route 41. And just when you began to see cars coming cresting the hill, I just put my hand out and said, we'd like you to protect
that,
everything above. And the next day they called back and said, yes.
Oh, Good.
So we were in business. Then looking at the other way, because the view to the Taconic Range and the Hewitt High Hayfield is extraordinary. Mm-hmm. And we were concerned with that view. And so we talked to the Douglases who own that. Mrs. Douglas is a Blagden, Carrie and Ann Douglas. And in fact, the land belongs to their children. We wanted, again, that a triangle that would line up with the Kiter easement. Mm-hmm. So they sold that easement to us at a very modest rate. It was really their children's. And they said, well, it'd be nice if the kids could get something. They sold it probably, less than a tenth of what it was worth, but something. Mm-hmm. And so we got that triangle, and we also bought 60 feet in from Route 41. And the reason that we bought that, an easement on that, mm-hmm. is we didn't want somebody to buy that lot and then put evergreens all along the
right.
road.
That would block
the view. So that's all we needed. So now we had a story where we were protecting two major views. Mm-hmm. And I think Jim Dresser was instrumental in this. I think he was the head of the fundraising of this one. And Sharon and Sharon Land Trust were enormously helpful,
yes.
several hundred thousand from them. Mm-hmm. So it was an incredible cooperative deal between Sharon and Salisbury. Backing up a little, when the Twin Oaks field was bought, that was when Mary Alice was head, we raised a lot of money in Salisbury to help buy that field. So that was the first major cooperation between the two land trusts, buying the Twin Oaks field, then buying Torrey Hill, and we cooperated again in the other direction. I'll talk about that after we get through with Torrey Hill, if there's anything more, Torrey Hill.
What part of the Fairfield Farms does Hodgkiss own?
Hodgkiss owns your side of the road, where the barns are.
Okay, you're talking about what used to be the cornfields.
Yeah.
I mean,
everything that's on the east side of the road.
Okay.
Okay, the building rights had already been sold to the Department of Agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
But the actual fee ownership, when you have an easement, you can still sell the land, but the easement goes with it.
I see.
So that the Department of Agriculture had an easement on the Blum lands outside of that barn. They've got a barn cut out there.
Oh, yeah. Because they've got the house and they've got the three barns.
Yeah.
And then we had a cut out for our two acres because we had an acre and 7/8, and Foster and Jack got together and bought that sliver that was necessary so we would have the 2 acres.
Okay.
So, okay. When did you acquire the Torrey Hill property?
I'm going to guess 2007.
That's fine.
I think it's close. That's probably right.
I would guess that...
No. The Torrey Hill 2007. The Twin Oaks was in the 1990s. And we had a big party, Sharon and Salisbury.
I remember that.
Jack Blum on the lawn there.
I remember that
party. We had music and everything else, and celebrated getting the Twin Oaks field.
Yeah.
And then after we bought Torrey Hill, we had a big picnic there for both Sharon and Salisbury again, because they'd helped us buy Torrey Hill.
Now, from the back of our house next to Torrey Hill, Fairfield Farms, we were the only ones that could see Beeslick Pond and Red Mountain.
Mm-hmm.
When did you get the Red Mountain property?
The Red Mountain property, that's part of another... we'll get into that.
Okay.
One of the other places we cooperated was Red Mountain, mm-hmm. and that's in Sharon. So a fellow named Longstreth owned that property, and he wanted to sell it. And so Larry Power came to me and started a conversation about how we would do that. And again, I always think of the landscape.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said, this is going to be a better sale, a better project, if we can get the Briscoes to protect those high fields that run into it. And so we went and talked to the Briscoes to find out if there was any way. And again, you know, this belongs to their children, and they were not really in a position to give it all away. Mm-hmm. And we arrived at an arrangement that there are 2 building lots up there.
Yep.
They're not in places that would be visible. One is back far, and another one would be vaguely visible, but it's behind the tree line, and they're not allowed to clear cut the tree line. They can get a view out.
Yeah, but not clear cut.
So they have two very valuable lots up there. Should they decide they need to use them, they're probably hoping they won't. Of course, it depends on how long it stays a family place.
Sure.
But anyway, they agreed to that. So again, that made that really work, so that that whole ridge line now was protected. They have a graveyard up there. They have a family graveyard up on the top of that hill.
One I don't have to inspect.
And, you know, it was interesting because the fact that we were doing Briscoes, this is a very view-conscious community, and what things look like is often a bigger factor when we're trying to raise money than whether there's a bog turtle on it or not.
The bog turtles come in second
to
the view.
The bog turtles, everyone will acknowledge they're important, but the checks aren't as big.
Well put.
But the fact that we had the Briscoes in, I'm not going to mention names, but someone who saw that, who hadn't given to us before, gave us $25,000. And there was someone else that we knew that saw it, and A knew B, and made a phone call. And as soon as we sent them our nonprofit proof of nonprofit, we got another $25,000.
Well, that's how it works.
Because, you know, these people were had this view, and they appreciated it.
Yeah.
And
one hand washes the other with the oral histories. This is how I get names.
Yeah.
Which is important. So, when did Red Mountain come in?
Well, 2000...
Roughly.
12, I don't know. You know.
And the Sycamore?
Sycamore Field has its own interesting story. HVA had lined up a GE grant. And GE came to a consent decree with Environmental Protection to do certain things for the benefit of the river to compensate for the damage that had been done by the PCBs up in Pittsfield.
So, where is this property?
Sycamore Field is just below the high school on Route 7. If you go Route 112 to Route 7 and turn right towards Cornwall, it's a quarter mile on your left. It's a large field.
Oh.
It had been a Lorch field, Lorch Farm, and then a Belter Farm field.
Yep.
And now it's Salisbury Association owns that.
Okay.
And we're currently leasing it to the Jackiers.
The Jacksons?
Jackiers in Canaan.
Oh.
Jackier Dairy Farmers.
Okay.
So HVA had lined up some GE grant money for that. And they...
HVA is...
Housatonic Valley Association.
Okay.
And they had felt that the... Appalachian Trail might want to own it. The Appalachian Trail was right below there.
Mm-hmm.
And as it turned out, the Appalachian Trail didn't. And so Tim Abbott called me up and said, would Salisbury Association like to own this? And could they kick in $50,000 to help tie up all the ends of getting the work done? And we said yes and yes.
Mm-hmm.
So then we became the owners of Sycamore Field.
Why is it called Sycamore Field?
Well, it's got a bunch of sycamores down along the river.
I was hoping.
Yeah. And we're hoping for more, and we're going to try and keep them happy and alive.
They can be very long-lived.
Yes, they can be, and very large. Beautiful tree.
Where I worked in Kent, there was a sycamore tree on her property, and it was supposedly 150 years old.
Yeah, sure.
It was a big tree.
Yeah.
When did Sycamore Fields come in? Roughly.
Yeah, that's another roughly. I would say 2014, maybe.
Okay. Oh, it's a nice continuum of lands and so forth.
Speaking of the GE money, we also got some GE grant money, which gave us money to do a conservation easement on the Grossman property and the Binzen property over along Weetog Road. So those are conservation easements that were accomplished with those GE remedial funds.
And that, I'm assuming, is General Electric from Pittsfield.
It's General Electric, yeah. They had, because of the damage they did, the deal was they were going to do things to help the river and the people along the river, and there were competitive grant applications. And HVA applied for the one to get money for Sycamore. We applied for ones. They got money for Grossman and Benson.
I see. And they're out on Weetalk.
Yes.
Okay. Anything that you want to add to the land trust portion before we go on to Habitat?
Bus trips?
Oh, sure.
Okay, the bus trips. Back in the 1990s, Mary Alice White said, let's do something to get the community out on the land. And I thought, well, yes, but let's do something that's a little different than just going out and looking at a nice piece of property. And while I was trying to discover what to do, I visited my friend John Mitchell in Lincoln, Massachusetts. And by coincidence, a Salisbury School graduate himself, he's been the head of the Audubon magazine up there for 20 years. Fantastic magazine, no longer being published. Anyway, he'd written a book called Ceremonial Time, in which he talked about everything that had happened on his property since the Ice Age. And he has walks in the woods where he envisions Indians around a campfire. Mm-hmm. It's imaginary.
Yeah.
But again, he's talking about the how what the land was and how it changed.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, this is what we need to do. Mm-hmm. So the idea was Salmon Kill Road. Let's look at Salmon Kill Road from a number of different aspects. So Ed Kirby is always the main
man. Oh, yeah.
Man.
He's wonderful.
We called up Ed, and Ed was on board. And so this became a bus and bicycle tour, because you could ride your bicycle from, we had four stops, and two school buses full and people on bicycles. Mm-hmm. And the first stop was at Salmon Kill Farm up on it. We got up on a hill there, Ed Kirby talked about the Ice Age and about the geology. And Donnie Stevens talks about what Native Americans might have been doing when they were there. We went on to the Lime Rock Iron Furnace,
mm-hmm.
and we had more from Ed Kirby. Not sure if anyone else spoke there. Oh, Chilio Berti spoke a couple of times.
Oh, good.
Chilio was in that furnace when it was operational.
Yeah.
And Chilio said, at the end of the workday, they had all this iron out in the pigs, and there'd be a little overflow, and they'd get some tongs and grab a chunk and throw it in a trough of water, and that would heat up the water. And that's what they did for washing up at the end. So that was just wonderful to hear that story. So we'll get back to Chilio in a minute. So we went to the furnace, and we learned all about the furnace and the railroad wheel stories. Mm-hmm. And, then we went back to Malcolm McLaren's farm, and Malcolm and Hank Belter each talked about their experiences farming on the land. And then Bob Estabrook talked about the railroad, which again connects back to the ironworks, because those were the guys that wanted this railroad to go through and get their railroad car wheels across the Hudson.
Absolutely.
So that was a very, very well-received tour, and everybody had a great time. The next tour would have been sometime in early 2000s, I would think, and that was a Mount Raga tour. And that had to do, again, with iron and with water power.
Mm-hmm.
So we had two school buses full of folks. It was a little, in order to get the school buses up Mount Raga Road, Jim Dresser had his little motor scooter, and we kind of stopped traffic from going down, and then he went down to make sure we were stopping traffic from going up, and like then sent the school buses up.
That is one road I will not drive.
And so up at the furnace, we had a wonderful talk by Tim Abbott about the ecology.
Mm-hmm.
And the history of the forest up there, and a little bit about the people up there.
Yep.
And then we had more talk, again, from Ed Kirby about the whole iron process and what would go on there, the difficulties of actually getting that ironworks established. I think a number of people went bankrupt trying to get it going, and then they finally did. And so more talk on the ironworks. And then we came down the hill and gathered at So they're calling it Pewter Pond now these days. Is that what they're calling it? The pond, the last pond, before you get to Selig Hill Road on your right, if you or the first on your left.
That one I don't know.
Okay. I think it's been referred to. Pewter Pond. But anyway, so we stopped there because there was a place to let people out and gather. Mm-hmm. And there were about, I think, 8 different places where the water gathered in different, so that they could hold it back and then use it for power.
Sure.
On the way down. So we had various talks about the different kinds of manufacturing and why this is in fact called Factory Street.
Right.
And, of course, Washini Street, because one of the factories was the
Washini woolen mill. It came from Twin Lakes.
Yeah. So that's a little bit of...
I learned a lot from you.
So that's some of that story. So that was the second bus tour.
I must have been on the third one then.
The third one started out up at Hammertown Road. It was the all-town tour. We had 3 buses full, and up at we got up to Taconic and Hammertown, where you've got that lovely view of the whole ridge. Mm-hmm. And we let Ed Kirby at it again to talk a little bit about again geology and
he's good at that.
Why this place looks like it looks like, and then Curtis Rand gave a talk about forest succession. But the highlight of Curtis's talk was after he'd given his prepared remarks. This was an October tour.
Yeah.
He looked across at the hillside. He said, "See that yellow? You know, those are ash. See the these." And he read the whole hillside. See that dark green? Those are hemlocks. That ravine is so steep that it's never been logged. And he just read the whole hillside by its fall colors. And I thought that was actually a highlight.
It was wonderful. It was just wonderful.
So then we went on and went over between the Lakes Road and over to the Great Falls, where we had, I think, probably had talks by Dick Paddock and Lou on the kind of industry there. And, of course, that was once a great ironworks and the cannon works. And then it was a big train repair place.
Yep.
And now it's back to nature.
Yep.
It's all gone. And I think I gave a talk on forestry, quoting Norm Sills, that in 1900 there were 100 family farms in Salisbury. By 1950 there were 50, and I'll finish that up. By now there really aren't any.
No, there aren't.
So that's kind of his. They're still farming, but it's more beef and horse.
It's not dairy, not so much.
So that was actually 3 school buses full.
Yes.
And then we went over to the iron furnace again. The Lime Rock Iron Furnace is where we finished up.
Yep. That was I went on that one.
Yeah.
So I can attest that was a wonderful thing to do.
Yeah, that one we actually, the History Society was more engaged in that one. We did history in the other ones, but Lou and Dick actually participated in having it, how it was going
to
work out.
But it's so important to get people out to see.
Yeah.
Because, you know, one of the things that I do with the oral history is we'll talk about something like the Lime Rock Furnace. Mm-hmm. All right, so I have to go find the street number.
Mm-hmm.
So that if somebody's going through Lime Rock, it's down that street.
Yeah.
So that you can pinpoint.
Yeah.
Because, like, where the classic car show place is in Lime Rock used to be one of the Richardson or Barnum estates that burned.
Okay.
So if you're talking about that, and you don't know where it is,
you're
never going to find it. But if you say, well, this is where the New England Classic Car Garage is, it's a flat piece of land. So it's important to do that.
One of the effects of the Ragged Tour is for probably for 7 or 8 years, I did walking tours.
I know you did.
As part of the Northwest Housatonic Heritage, the Upper Housatonic Heritage Fall Walk Day. I did 7 or 8 times. I did Washington Street water power tours.
Yep. Fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. Now, shall we move on to habitat?
Yes.
We're now ready to do houses. We've done the landscape. Now we're going to do houses. Okay.
We'll do houses. So, so Mary Alice White, back when she was the chairman of the Land Trust, was always concerned for land protection, but she was always concerned about housing, and particularly affordable housing. Are there going to be places for people that work here to be able to live here? And with her encouragement, I went off and joined Habitat for Humanity to try and see if I could address that issue in some small way. One of the interesting things that we have done in Habitat for Humanity is to have the homeowners buy the improvements but lease the land. That makes the land cheaper to buy, makes the property cheaper for them to buy, and it makes it easier for us to buy back, because our business plan, so far successful, is that we're going to buy these houses back when they come on the market. When we have a Habitat house and a Habitat house site, we don't want it to get away if we can help it. I know there was a problem with earlier on affordable housing things in town. They were affordable for the first people that got them, but they weren't affordable anymore after that.
No.
And so our goal, and when people buy these houses at a modest price, their resale is restricted to that price plus cost of living increase.
Ah,
so when it goes on the market, the sale price to us is market value or sales price plus cost of living, whatever's less.
Mm-hmm.
We have the right to buy it. And if we can't buy it, it still has to be made available to people at or below the median income level for 6 months.
What's the median income level?
Oh, it's probably $60,000 a year.
Median.
Okay. Well, that's still... still isn't, you know, the investment banker from New York.
No, right? And it's not school teacher salary either.
Well, school teacher could buy that house.
Now they could.
Yeah, well, that's now come on the market.
Of course, I started at $5,000, so $60,000 looked like a lot of money to me.
But anyway, that's our goal, and so far we're successful. We have had three or four houses that have turned over. We've bought them, gone in if they needed any rehab, and rehabitated them again. And so far we've been successful in doing that, keeping them in the Habitat portfolio. And we hope to continue that way.
Is this the only chapter that does it that way?
To my knowledge, I don't know of anyone else that does it that way. And with the help of Barbara Biggis, when she was town assessor, we rewrote our land leases in a manner that would satisfy the state of Connecticut as being an affordable housing. They want to know that it's going to remain affordable X years into the future. And we wrote a lease that satisfied that. And so that allowed Barbara to actually remove the land portion from the tax rolls on these houses. Habitat owns the land, and it's being used for their charitable purposes, so it's available to be tax-exempt.
How many houses do you have in your portfolio?
I'm going to say a dozen.
Oh, that's a good number.
Well, we started out fairly slowly.
Yeah.
And we're trying to do one a year now. That's our goal, and every once in a while there's this enthusiasm to try and build faster, and I always say, let's just see if we can do one a year well.
You
know, well, in 20 years, you'll have 20 more houses, you know, and if they can, that's really substantial. We're chugging along pretty well. It's a very complicated organization. Mm-hmm. Not only do we have to raise the money, not only have to we build the houses, but we hold the mortgages as well.
Right.
And that's why the homeowner can have a interest-free mortgage, because we're the bank for them. It also means that if you get behind on your payments, we'll talk to you.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we have, a good number of our people have run a little bit behind, and we're willing to carry them as long as we believe they have a chance to really do it. We have had a foreclosure, and you look at something and you just see, this isn't going to happen. It can't happen.
Yeah.
And so reluctantly, we will foreclose. But we also can be very generous in changing arrangements, extending things, putting off payments. You know, if it looks like something can get back on track.
When a house becomes available, do you have a lot of applicants?
It's varied. We've been getting more and better applicants of late. I think we've been, you know, we go out to the banks actually, mm-hmm. as well as the social service people, mm-hmm. and there's more word of mouth from other habitat owners as well. Our last two houses in Canaan were actually friends, you know. So we did one house, and then he sent his friend who got the next house.
Oh, good.
And I think the first one was. One of them, at least, was somebody that went to the bank for a mortgage, and the bank said, "We can't lend you the money. Why don't you talk to Habitat?"
So they good.
So they referred them to us, and it's worked out well.
Oh, that's good.
So I think we have more connections out when we go to do it. Our latest homeowner in Falls Village is actually a woman that knows Arabic and is helping in the Salisbury Central School with the Syrian kids.
Good.
So that was an interesting connection. It's a Falls Village house, but that's one of her jobs.
Is your chapter Region 1?
Not quite. We started out being five towns without Kent, and then we took in Norfolk because we thought a Star Child was an early member, and we thought we had a line on some property there. But that didn't work out. But we've had a lot of good board members from Norfolk, including past president.
Who is?
Olson. What's his first name? The Congregational Minister, Eric Olson from Norfolk. He was the past president of Habitat.
First name?
Eric, E-R-I-K, Olson.
Okay. Have you actually gone out with hammer and saw to work on
this? I've gone out, but I'm not...
You're not a carpenter.
I'm not skilled. And,
In that area.
I more do stuff in and around the town hall and planning and zoning.
Okay.
Our five-lot subdivision in Falls Village, kind of towards Music Mountain,
mm-hmm.
You know, I was the one that got that through subdivision, knowing nothing about it, just going to the meetings, and they said, well, you've got to do this, so I went and did it, and then, well, you've got to do that, so I went and did it, you know. So it took more than a year, but, you know, we got the subdivision.
Oh, good.
And that gave us, it was a five-lot subdivision. It gave us four building lots, and we sold one of them to help for all the cost of getting those four lots, because that land was land from, Weimar Park was made out of that land. That's where a lot of the sand and gravel came from, Weimar Park.
When Jimmy Vail owned it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And
okay.
So, you know, actually, it kind of looks like a wasteland, particularly when we got there, but it's kind of nice to be down and away from the road. I think it works out very nicely.
Sound goes over.
Yeah.
All righty. The last thing that you wanted to talk about was the women's...
Support services.
Support system. Tell me about that. I didn't know it was the Salisbury organization.
Well, like Habitat, it's a multi-town organization. When I joined it, it was called Women's Emergency Services.
And when did you join?
It would have been, probably the late 90s.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And, you know, if we knew when the Violence Against Women Act, I think, might have been 2007. I'm not sure. I was still on there when that went through. So it was started, I got on there when Trade Secrets first met over at Bunny Williams' house.
That was a long time ago.
Yeah. So, in fact, in our second one at Bunny Williams' Trade mm-hmm. Secrets, we had snow.
And messed up her lawn tremendously. Well, I used to stuff envelopes for that.
So that went on, and part of the reason I got involved with that is my sister is very active in domestic violence issues down in Washington, D.C. And she called me up and said, well, you guys, we're doing this national campaign around There's No Excuse for Domestic Violence and trying to do for domestic violence what Mothers Against Drunk Driving did for drinking, to not keep it secret, to have it be open and not acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
And so I told her, you know, about these stickers, which actually came from New York City, apparently. This is a safe haven, the stickers that are everywhere.
Yep.
And so I'm not aware if anyone's ever made use of them, but it alerts everybody in town that there's an organization here that cares, is willing to do something, and it alerts men and women both that there's the domestic violence is an issue and that there's an active organization here. So I told her about these, and she said, well, we're going to have hearings. You should come down and testify. So Rona Roberts and I and a couple other people. Rona was co-president.
Who was the other person?
I went down. Rona Roberts went down.
What Roberts?
Rona. R-O-N-A.
Roberts?
Yeah, Rona Roberts.
From where?
She was living at what's called Renegade Farm on Britton Hill Road at that
okay.
time.
Yeah.
And is it Nancy Beersdorfer?
Okay.
So she was the co. They were co-presidents. And Rona and I, and it was, I believe, a Patty someone who was the director of Women's Support Services working out of the Falls Village train station at this point. We all went down, and Rona actually testified before then-Congressman Schumer's Health and Human Services Committee, and then we went over to the press club, and this was all part of the launch of that campaign and a push towards getting the Violence Against Women Act passed through Congress, which did pass and eventually provided funding that helped Women's Support Services get their building in Sharon.
Okay. And it's still very active, obviously.
It is very active, and with trade secrets, very successful. It really is satisfactorily funded to have the kind of staff that they would want, I think. And they've got a good number of staff, so...
Do you know how many staff they have?
I don't know how many, but I mean, even when I was there, we'd started to do school programs.
Yes, that's what we were going to get to.
Yeah.
Because they work with the... Who's the time?
Youth Service Bureau,
which is where I've heard of the Women's Support Service. Is there anything that you'd like to add before we close?
Let's close, and I'll take a minute. But we can go back and reopen.
Okay. Thank you so much.
I think that's plenty.